we continue with our quest to describe the non-trivial nature of space-time, the shape that it has, or the curvature that it has. Remember, there are many ways to capture the curvature of space-time. One of them was to check whether the angle sum in a triangle is 180 degrees or not. Another possibility was to check for the validity or violation of Pythagoras' law. And that leads to the notion of metric. And another possibility was to capture the shape of a manifold by checking for the non-triviality, the potential non-triviality of parallel transport of vectors around closed loops. This led to the approach of describing curvature using Christoffel symbols, the affine connection. Now, the metric and the affine connection approach have a drawback that may be important for the purposes of quantum gravity. And the drawback that I'm referring to is that these are rather redundant descriptions of the structure of space-time. Why is that? Well, consider two Riemannian manifolds in the case of metric descriptions. So there is a manifold which is given by some differentiable manifold and a metric on it. And let's say we have another differentiable manifold with a metric on it. It could also be the same differentiable manifold and you put two different metrics on it. If there exists an isometric metric preserving diffeomorphism between them, an isomorphism between those two structures, then we need to say that they describe the same structure, the same object with curvature. So if there exists a diffeomorphism that takes the manifold with its metric into the image manifold with its metric, such a way that it preserves the metric, such a way that if you pull the metric from here using the diffeomorphism over there, you actually get the metric over there, then we say that the diffeomorphism is metric preserving. That is to say, if when we apply the induced map, the diffeomorphism induces, if you remember, maps between the tangent spaces, between the cotangent spaces, the function spaces, and the tensor spaces. And in particular, the diffeomorphism will induce a map from the space of covariant two tensors into the space of covariant two tensors. And if you do that, if you take the diffeomorphism from the manifold into the other manifold, and you end up mapping the metric into the metric tensor that was already there, then you say that it is a metric preserving isomorphism of the two manifolds. And in this case, we might as well say that we were dealing with the same object all along, and all we did by applying the diffeomorphism was to supply a possible change of charts. So these two manifolds are really the same, they only differ by the way we look at them. It's just a different parametrization of them. Now, I have to be careful that I don't skip half pages there, as happened yesterday. So when we have two Riemannian manifolds or pseudo-Riemannian manifolds that are related by an isometric diffeomorphism, then they are merely coordinate changes of another. That is to say, they describe the same structure. And we therefore introduce the terminology that a Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian structure, let's call it chi, is an equivalence class, it's an equivalence class of pseudo-Riemannian manifolds which can be mapped into each other by metric preserving diffeomorphisms. That is to say, by changes of coordinates. For example, somebody may give you a metric g mu nu of x and say, this is a very interesting spacetime. And then somebody else comes up and gives you another metric g mu nu of x, g mu nu tilde of x, let's say, and says, no, that's a much more interesting spacetime. And then maybe you find a change of coordinates such that the one turns out to be exactly the same as the other. In that case, we have to say that they describe the exact same space-time. It's the same space-time, just in two different coordinate systems. So we shouldn't be blinded by the exact shape that a metric tensor takes. What really is the space-time is the equivalence classes of all those metric tensors that can be transformed into each other by changes of coordinates. So a space-time is a metric modulo all possible changes of coordinates. All possible diffeomorphisms of the manifold into itself, taking the metric along. The problem with this definition is that these equivalence classes are very hard to handle. If somebody gives you two metrics, g and g tilde, in explicit coordinates, and you're asked to find out whether or not they describe the same manifold, you find it very difficult to do this. How would you go about it? There are some things you can do. For example, you can calculate the curvature tensor. And if it turns out that for one metric, the curvature tensor comes out zero, and for the other it is not, then you know it's got to be different manifolds. But in general, it is super difficult to find out whether or not two given metrics belong to the same space-time, whether they belong to the same Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian structure, that is. Do they belong to the same equivalence class? Are they related by a change of chart? And you may wonder, well, why would we care? If we have one representation, I mean, if we have the space-time described by one metric, isn't that good enough? Why do we have to worry about other possible ways to write down the same space-time? Now, in classical physics, maybe there is not much reason to worry about it, except if you are faced with the situation of having to decide whether, for example, two freshly found solutions to the Einstein equation are maybe the same solution or not, because they could be the same space-time, just in different coordinates. So that would be one occasion where it comes up classically. But quantum mechanically, it comes up automatically, this problem of classification, this problem of identifying whether two given metrics are the same space-time or not. See, in quantum theory, we have to, in one point of view, in the formulation of Feynman, we have to do a sum over all possible trajectories, over all possible things that can happen. It's a path integral. And if you want to do a path integral over space-time configurations, over space-times, then ideally, we would write down the path integral. I will write it down in a sec. We would write down the path integral where we integrate such that we have in the integral one representative from each equivalence class. So there would be, you know, we want to integrate over all pseudo-Riemannian structures, over all space-times. And since each space-time has a gazillion different descriptions in terms of metrics that differ just by changes of coordinates, we want just one. So for every Riemannian structure, we have a metric. So we integrate, we path integrate over all metrics, but not really all of them, just inequivalent metrics, right? Just those that really describe different space-times. So we would have to pick out of each equivalence class one representative that we want in the integral to occur. That is also what is called a choice of gauge. When you have equivalence classes and you want to pick one representative out of each equivalence class, then that's a choice of gauge, or a fixing of gauge. As I said, this comes up in What? How does this happen? Okay. All right. So let us look at the path integral for gravity. Let's go about it very naively. The path integral consists in the sum of all paths, or the integral over all possible paths, of all possible evolutions that a physical system can undertake, where for each one of those evolutions we have a probability amplitude. And in the case of gravity, this should be the gravitational action that we will later cover. It doesn't matter for the argument that I will explain now what exactly that action is. Whether it's the Einstein-Hilbert action or another action, it's going to be some action. So for every Lorentzian, for every pseudo-Riemannian structure, for every space-time, we get a number, namely the action. And then e to the power of I times the action is the probability amplitude, roughly speaking, for this evolution to happen. And if we sum them all up, we get what is called the partition function. And from that, with clever techniques, we can then derive expectation values, correlators, and everything else that can be predicted in quantum theory. So here these symbols, capital chi, stand for Riemannian structures, or pseudo-Riemannian structures. So we want to integrate over all pseudo-Riemannian structures, and each pseudo-Riemannian structure can be captured by writing down one metric tensor, G mu of x. Except we have to be terribly careful not to put metrics up here in this integral that would describe the same space-time. We want one contribution from each space-time. But that's impossible. Because it's impossible to distinguish whether two metrics belong or don't belong to the same equivalence class. In general, there's no there's no simple method to do this. So what we can do instead is that we integrate over all metrics and then put a Dirac delta in here that is a gauge-fixing condition. It will be a condition on metrics that is fulfilled only for one metric out of each gauge equivalence class. In this way, we can integrate over all metrics, but the delta peaks only once, namely when the gauge condition is fulfilled. And in this way, ideally, we would pick out one metric per Riemannian structure, or pseudo-Riemannian structure in this path integral. Actually, there would also be a chain rule factor because the delta would be not delta of the metric directly, but of a function of the metric. And if you remember, if you have the delta of a function, then yes, then you have an integral or a sum over chain rule factors. And these chain rule factors then in particle physics translate into so-called ghost fields and stuff. So we'd either like to integrate over all metrics, or we may want to integrate over all Christoffel symbols, either way, over all affine connections. Either way, we have to put some sort of gauge-fixing condition here. Trouble is that this is just not doable. So a lot of quantum gravity research is concerned with overcoming that conundrum. In electromagnetism, we face the same problem. In QCD and the weak interaction, the same problem. There are field configurations. For example, in electromagnetics, there is the A mu field, electromagnetic vector potential. And you can have two different A mu fields that describe exactly the same physics, the same electric and the same magnetic fields. They can differ by a gradient, if you remember. We had this earlier in the course. So if we want to do a path integral in electromagnetism, again, we have to fix a gauge. We have to put a condition there in those Dirac deltas that allow us to integrate over all A. The Dirac delta will take care of picking out just one A mu field out of each gauge equivalence class. We have to fix gauge. And we can, there are many different ways to do that. There's temporal gauge, Lorentz gauge, Feynman gauge, and so on. And there it is doable. And it's doable essentially because electromagnetism is fundamentally a linear theory. But gravity is not. There's no linear superposition principle for metrics. And so, whereas electromagnetic fields have that. And so for gravity, it's just not practically manageable. We can write things down, but cannot do anything with it. So what I've become interested in, therefore, is to try to look for alternatives. I mean, we've been looking at several ways that we can describe the non-triviality of the shape of a space-time or a general any structure. And there is another way that has been pioneered a long time ago by Hermann Weyl, and that's the approach of spectral geometry. Spectral geometry goes back to the beginning of the 20th century. Oh, yes.
I'm just a little confused about some of this stuff. So you said that two metrics in an equivalence class, two metrics belong to the same equivalence class, are the same up to a coordinate transformation. But I don't really understand how that's different from what we talked about before, where you can write down a metric in a different coordinate system, but it's still the same metric. I don't understand. Is this the same thing, or is this something else?
Oh, no. That's something very different. If, for example, you take Minkowski space, and you take the Itamuonu metric, right? Then you can change coordinates in Minkowski space, go into some sort of carousel coordinates, for example, that spin, and maybe they travel while they spin, or something like this. In this case, if you now calculate what the metric tensor is, it will look super complicated. It will be very much non-diagonal and everything, right? But if you calculate the metric the curvature tensor from it, you will find it's zero everywhere,
right?
Because it's still describing Minkowski space. Okay? But now take, for example, the Schwarzschild solution, its metric tensor, and calculate some. Use some funny coordinate system, again, spinning, traveling, and so on. Then the metric tensor, again, will look super complicated. If you calculate the curvature, you will find that there is curvature now. And since we know that a change of coordinates cannot make a tensor non-zero that is zero and vice versa, we can conclude that there is no diffeomorphism that would map the Minkowski metrics in whatever coordinate system you start with. There's no diffeomorphism that would map it into the Schwarzschild solution, because it would have to make the curvature tensor non-zero.
Right. So from zero. What are the other metrics that belong to the equivalence class of the Minkowski metric? Isn't it just the Minkowski metric?
No, it's the Minkowski metric, and all the metric tensors that you can get, all the 4x4 matrix valued functions that you can get by diffeomorphism.
Okay, so
that's a huge class of them.
But aren't those the same metric, just written in a different basis?
Exactly. But initially, remember how the Riemannian manifolds are defined. You start with a differentiable manifold, and then you put a metric tensor on it, and then bang, you call it, this is my Riemannian manifold, or the pseudo-Riemannian manifold. And then if you start with a different metric tensor, a priori, it's a different Riemannian manifold, because you've put something else on it. You might even have started with a fresh differential manifold, put a fresh metric on it, but they have to be considered as describing the same physical object if they belong into that same equivalence class. You see? And so then the physically different structures are the ones that cannot be obtained from each other in this way. So for example, you may use computer algebra to solve the Einstein equations. And you come up with a solution. You think
you had only one participant for the last 30 minutes.
I think this is about our connection to Guelph. We'll have to rely on the videographers to keep that under control. Right. So imagine you use computer algebra, you find a solution to the Einstein equations, and you say, oh, that's fantastic. I found a new solution. But you still have to check whether or not there is a diffeomorphism to another known solution to the Einstein equations, because it might actually describe the same space-time. So I became interested in spectral geometry. That's why I want to tell you about that field today, because spectral geometry offers a way to describe the shape of space-times without any of these problems. They completely go away. here the idea is this. While asked, I mean, not that exact question, but let me put it in this way. Imagine you have a vase for flowers made out of glass, and there's no water in there, there are no flowers in there. You take a spoon to it, and you will start vibrating and make a sound. And then you take another vase of a different shape, and you listen to it as well as you tap it with a spoon. If you do that with a lot of vases, and you always carefully listen to the sound that they make, you may, after a while, get some systematics in this. And you will notice that the bigger ones have a lower pitch than the smaller ones. And maybe you can start hearing things like whether the vases have great symmetry, or maybe they have not so much symmetry. Maybe they have handles or bumps sticking out or dents in there. Maybe you can hear that. And definitely, you will hear it if you change it. But if you've done this, a lot of experiments like that, you might get experience associating the sound to the shape. And Weil was asking, how much of the shape can we gather from just knowing what the sound is? See, that's, I think, of interest on many levels. First of all, the spectrum that we hear of a manifold, and I will explain more about this in a moment, the spectrum of a manifold that we hear consists of geometric invariants. It does not matter in which coordinate system you calculate it. Right? It's just, it has a certain spectrum, and that's what it is. And each eigenvalue, each frequency with which it vibrates, is a property of the manifold. More accurately, it is a property of the Riemannian structure. It is not a property of the Riemannian manifold, it's a property of the Riemannian structure. It is completely the same for all elements in one equivalence class. Because it doesn't matter in which coordinate system you calculate what the vibration spectrum of such an object is. So the spectrum consists of infinitely many geometric invariants. And so you can rephrase Weil's question as the question, how much about the shape do these geometric invariants tell us? Could it be complete? Could it be the complete information? Now that would be cool, right? If just from the sound alone, we could capture the shape. Because then we could use the sound as a representative of the shape. And instead of trying to quantize the shapes, we could say our degrees of freedom are the eigenvalues. And we look at the eigenvalues, and they're canonically conjugate. We write an action for the eigenvalues. We consider the dynamics of the eigenvalues. We quantize the eigenvalues, have canonical commutation relations for the eigenvalues, stuff like that. And then whenever you want, you can retranslate that into a shape and a manifold. But for the actual quantization, the actual calculations, you may want to do that with the spectrum, because that's pure information. It has nothing to do with diffeomorphisms. The diffeomorphism group has been modeled out already there. So Weil asked in 1911, does the spectrum encode all about the shape? Now, the answer is no. But it's too good an idea to give up. So we thought we study why. Why no? And can it be overcome? Can it be turned into a yes? Maybe we just overlooked something there. So the rest of this lecture is going to be about that. So if M, first of all, if the manifold has infinite volume, then it's hopeless from the start. Because if it has infinite volume, then the spectrum of the vibration spectrum of it is going to be a continuum. And when you have a continuum, then there is no structure to glean from it. We need a discrete spectrum, so we need a finite volume. That in practice is not a problem, because you can always approximate our universe by a even if it is topologically R3, even if it goes on forever in space, we are only causally connected to some dozens of light years of it. So we can always assume this to be the part that we are connected to be part of a larger, compactified, finite volume universe. It's just the usual trick of an infrared cutoff. And secondly, another fundamental difficulty is to do spectral geometry for pseudo-Riemannian manifolds. It's very little developed still. Before we go into the technical things, theorems and stuff like that, what I'm intrigued by spectral geometry is something that Weyl couldn't have known about, because 1911 was pre-quantum mechanics, which was starting in 1925, 26. It was pre-general relativity, 1915. So he had no idea. But spectral geometry combines the mathematical languages of quantum theory and general relativity, because shape is described by differential geometry. Sound is spectra. This is eigenvalues of operators on Hilbert space. And differential geometry looks like it has nothing to do with functional analysis and vice versa. But spectral geometry naturally combines the two. And it is clear that if we are to bring together the physics of general relativity with the physics of quantum theory, then this will only be possible if we also bring together the math of it. A unifying theory of quantum gravity must naturally reduce into general relativity in some limit and quantum theory in another limit. And in this case, the unifying mathematical language must reduce to differential geometry and functional analysis. So the top level thing must naturally combine the two branches of math. So considering this, it seemed to be too much of an opportunity to miss. And it is true that in the past 100 years, manifolds have been found, which are isospectral, so they have the same sound. If you build them as an object and tap on them with a spoon, they have the same sound, but they're not isometric. Okay? They exist. But let's see why. How could that be? And maybe there's something that we can do to distinguish these manifolds anyway. Okay, so here's a theorem. Let's assume that a Riemannian manifold is compact, it has a finite volume, and it has no boundary. You can also handle the case with a boundary, but let's make life simpler by omitting the presence of a boundary. After all, we don't see any boundaries in the universe. Then the theorem says, for any compact Riemannian manifold, we have that the spectrum of the Laplace operator on that manifold is discrete. I shouldn't really say Laplace operator, I should say Laplace operators, because if you remember, there's a Laplace operator for every degree of differential forms. There's a Laplace operator on zero forms, there's a Laplace operator on one forms, a Laplace operator on two forms, etc. And all of them are just, right? And remember that these preserve the degree. So the Laplace operator is mapping zero forms into zero forms, one forms into one forms, two forms into two forms, etc. So we might as well consider this to be different Laplace operators, or we can just decompose it into a Laplace operator on zero forms, one forms, two forms, etc., up until the top forms, the n forms. So what the theorem says is that the spectrum of each one of these Laplace operators, or the spectrum of the Laplace operator on P forms, is discrete. Each eigenvalue has only a finite degeneracy, and there are no accumulation points. In other words, it's nice. There may be a lot of information in the spectra. And as I said, as far as the universe is concerned, we can always take a finite chunk of it in order to make the volume finite. The larger difficulty is to take into account the space-time part of space-time. If you just take a spatial part, a spatial slice, then that is a matter of Riemannian geometry. But space-time is, of course, Lorentzian geometry, and several of the things that I will talk about today should really be restricted to Riemannian geometries because they haven't been extended yet to Lorentzian geometries. So let us look at the types of sound that a manifold can make. And this was really the starting point for our considerations in my group when we said, okay, let's reconsider Weyl's hypothesis or Weyl's question. How much of the shape can we hear in the sound? And the idea was this. Maybe the problem is that in the literature, they were looking at sound in a naive way. They were just checking what is the sound, what is the scalar sound. If you have a manifold and you have a scalar field living on that, it may make a sound. A spectrum can be recorded. And then the question would be, how much information does this spectrum have about the shape of the manifold? But the curvature of the manifold is a tensorial object. And the question arises whether a scalar field knows enough about the tensorial properties of curvature to be able to tell us everything about the curvature. It could be, this was the idea, that what we have to consider is not just the sound that the manifold makes when a scalar field vibrates on it, but also the sound that it makes when, I don't know, a one-form field, two-form field, three-form field vibrates on it. We have Laplace operators. We can describe wave equations, not just for zero forms, one forms, two forms, three forms, etc., up to four forms in space-time. So maybe there is more information to be had. We should look also into the spectrum of the Laplace operator on P forms. And if we only collect all those spectra, maybe then if those spectra are taken all together, maybe they capture all of the curvature of space-time. The answer is no, but let's see why, and then let's try to improve over that. Okay, so what types of waves shall we consider? Well, for example, there's the Schrödinger equation that we can write down on a space-time, on a space. So let's say you have the Schrödinger equation on a vase, a Schrödinger equation on any compact Riemannian manifold. Don't think of actual GR just yet. Just take a Riemannian manifold fixed, compact Riemannian manifold fixed, and fixed in time, so no dynamics in it. And we just look at the spectrum of waves that live on that space-time. And for example, we can put the Schrödinger equation to live on our space. So here's the Schrödinger equation. The heat equation takes the same form, except that there's no I here. And then there's the Klein-Gordon equation. Also, acoustic equations would have second-time derivatives here. Now, you may wonder, OK, so different physical scenarios, different equations. That means different information from each of them. Not really. And the reason is that what really matters here is just this operator here, the Laplace operator. The time dependence doesn't matter. And the reason is that all those differential equations are separable. We can say we can solve for the time dependence separately from the space dependence. And it's the space dependence that will give us the frequencies. So each of these equations of motion, and I should say that we did allow here for these equations not only to be number valued, not only to be zero form valued, but p-form valued, because we can put here the Laplacian on p-forms. Okay, so this describes also wave equations that we may not be used to. I mean, for example, the heat equation for p-forms makes really no sense physically, right? Because the temperature is a scalar. But you could write down a Schrödinger equation for p-forms, or a Klein-Gordon equation for them. All right, so each of them can be solved by separation of variables. And then, you see, imagine we find an eigenform. So it's an eigenvector to the Laplace operator, an eigenform, omega tilde, of the Laplace operator on the manifold. Let's say it's a p-form. Let's say this p-form is an eigenform to the Laplace operator. So that is to say that if you take the Laplace operator, this thing, and apply it onto this p-form, you get the same p-form back up to a up to an eigenvalue. We know that those guys exist because we know that the Laplace operator is self-adjoint. Each part of it is self-adjoint, and each p-form space is self-adjoint, so we know it has an eigenbasis. And the inner product in the Hilbert space is this one, if you remember. We have p-forms omega and nu, and then the inner product in the Hilbert space of p-forms is given by integral over the manifold omega veg star nu. How come this is a number? It's just remember why that is. If omega is a p-form and nu is a p-form, well, then the veg product between the two would be a 2p-form. We can't generally integrate that, but what are the chances that this happens to be an n-form, the top form, right? But if we take omega and nu to be p-forms, and we form this combination, omega veg star nu, that's a p, that's an n-form. Because remember, omega is a p-form, but star of a p-form is an n minus p-form. Okay? Remember what the Hodge star does. It takes p-forms into n minus p-form. So the whole thing is an n-form, where n is the dimension of the manifold, so it's a top form, and therefore it can be integrated over the manifold. That gives us a number, and if you remember, this thing is positive definite, at least in the Riemannian case. So we have that these guys are self-adjoint. And so this is guaranteed to happen. We have these eigenfunctions with real eigenvalues. And then the Schrödinger equation can be solved in this way, because we have already eigenfunctions here. Then we have that the time dependence is given by the space dependence times that, in the heat equation case times this, in the case of the Klein-Gordon equation, like that. So in order to find out the frequency of the oscillations, all we need to know is what the eigenvalues are of the Laplace operator in space. The actual form, whether it's a heat equation, Schrödinger equation, or Klein-Gordon equation, that tells us something about whether we have to square them or multiply them with I or something like that in order to get the frequencies, but they're in one-to-one correspondence. So the sound of a manifold is completely, the sound of waves on a manifold is completely captured by calculating the eigenfunctions to the spatial derivative operator, in this case, the Laplace operator. Okay. In other words, the spectrum of the Laplacian on p-forms is the overtone spectrum of p-form type waves on the manifold M. So concretely, you can think of it this way. Imagine you have this empty vase again, and you tap it with a spoon. Then the waves that are happening there, you can describe as scalar waves. You know, at each point of the vase, it either swings inwards or outwards. That's just how curvature works in two dimensions. In two dimensions, and this is like the surface of a vase, it's a two-dimensional thing. In two dimensions, curvature is actually scalar. So you can describe the deformation of the vase just by saying at each point, how much is it deviating in inwards or outwards. But you could imagine putting on the vase also other fields, vector-valued fields, tensor-valued fields, for example, one-form fields. And while that's not easy to implement, perhaps, but imagine you could, then you could tap the vase and you have now, in principle, a different spectrum. It's a different wave equation, a different spectrum. So think about it. It means if you just tap it with a spoon and you listen to the scalar sound of it, you get a certain sound of it. It has a certain ring to it. But if you listen to it by having a special microphone that doesn't pick up the scalar waves, that picks up the one-form waves, then the thing sounds different. And so the overall idea is that if you listen to different sound types, you get different types of information. Before you think that this is too wild and too speculative, let me remind you that this is daily practice in seismology. When, for example, the North Koreans set up another nuclear test, or an earthquake happens, then seismic waves are being generated. And seismic stations are trying to triangulate where does it come from, how strong was it, and so on. And they know that when an earthquake happens, there will not only be scalar pressure waves generated. You know, pressure waves are of the kind where rock presses on rock, presses on rock, presses on rock, and so on. And in this way, the pressure propagates. It propagates with a certain dispersion relation, with a certain speed to it, a certain relation between frequency and wavelength, and so on. They know all about this. But they also know that when an earthquake happens, rock is not just pressing against rock, it's also tilting against rock. So you have a tilt, which leads to a tilt, right? So you have a sidewards movement or angled movement. And you can see that this is not described by a scalar, this is going to be tensorial. So you have shear waves. And these shear waves also propagate through the rock. And it turns out they propagate with a different velocity, with a different relationship between frequency and wavelength. They have completely different propagation properties. For example, pressure waves can make it all the way through the crust of the Earth into the liquid interior and come out the other way again into the crust and so on. But shear waves will be reflected off the crust and liquid boundary, because shear waves cannot be existing in a liquid. It's the definition of a liquid that it doesn't support shear. So shear waves will go to the liquid-solid boundary and then reflect off it. This is, by the way, how we know that there is a liquid solid boundary. It's much too far down to drill down to it. So seismologists have known that for a long time, that different types of waves carry different types of information. It's valuable to measure all of them. You need different measurement instruments. You know, one that measures pressure, another one that measures shear. But it can be done. So here what we are saying is, let's be super careful with spectral geometry. Let's not just take one kind of waves. Let's see whatever is available. We look at all those Laplacians on all p-forms and see how much information the spectra all together gather. So it's clear that the curvature will impact the sound of the manifold for each of the p-form types of waves, but will it impact enough so that if we just listen to the sounds, we can reconstruct what the shape of the manifold is? Let's see. Right. Now, we can immediately collect from the properties of the Laplace operator that we have discussed in this course, we can immediately collect some properties of it that will be important for the spectral analysis of manifolds. So the spectra of the Laplace operator on p-forms, we expect to carry different information about the manifold. In the same way the seismologists know that shear waves carry different information, tensorial shear waves carry different information from scalar pressure waves. However, there are tight bounds, as it turns out, tight bounds on how different the information can possibly be that the p-forms see from comparing what p-forms know about curvature to comparing what p plus 1 forms know about curvature and so on. Different differential forms for different p don't really gather very different information about the curvature. And the reason is ultimately these three equations. Remember that the Laplace operator commutes with the Hodge star operator. Why is that? Well, basically because the co-derivative is itself star d star, right? And that's why you have lots of commutativity properties. You have that the Laplacian commutes with the Hodge star, and the Laplacian commutes with the exterior derivative, and it commutes with the co-derivative. Easy to see just from how it is written there. And you know from quantum mechanics, and isn't it amazing that we're doing differential geometry here, but we're using arguments from quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, when operators commute, you know that certain spectra are going to be degenerate, are going to be the same. And that's what we will find out. Because of these commutativity properties, we can tell something about how the spectra of some Laplacians, on, let's say, p-forms, are related to the spectra of Laplacians on p plus 1 or n minus p-forms, and so on. So there will be a relationship between the spectrum of Laplacian on p-forms and the spectrum of Laplacian on n minus p-forms and the spectrum of Laplacian on p plus 1 and p minus 1 forms. The reason being that this thing is shifting from p-forms to n minus p-forms. This one is increasing the degree by 1, that one is decreasing the degree by 1. So we should expect that, that there are relationships between the spectra of p-forms, p plus 1 forms, p minus 1 forms, and n minus p-forms. Let's get started with this. Let's use the fact that the Laplacian commutes with the Hochstar operator. So let's assume that omega is one of those let's first assume that omega is a p-form and that it is an eigen p-form, an eigenvector of the Laplace operator for p-forms with eigenvalue lambda. Okay, so omega is an eigenvector to the Laplacian. Then let's define nu as the star of omega. That's not a p-form, that's an n minus p-form now, because that's what the star does. Now let's apply the Laplace operator onto the new vector nu. It is Laplace operator acting on star omega, because that's how the nu was defined. But now remember that these two guys commute. So therefore, we can write this also the other way around, but once the Laplace operator acts directly on our differential form, it kicks in that it actually omega is an eigenvector, so we get the lambda, which you can pull in front, and therefore we see that nu is an eigenvector to the Laplacian with the same eigenvalue. But nu is an n minus p form. But this means that the spectrum of the Laplacian on p forms is the same as the spectrum of the Laplacian on n minus p forms, right away. We can even tell how the eigenvectors are related to each other. So that tells us right away that, we have 0 forms, 1 forms, 2 forms, 3 forms, 4 forms in space-time, where we go up to 4 dimensions. And that tells us that the 4 forms know as much about the curvature in their spectrum as the 0 forms do. The 3 forms know as much as the 1 forms do. And then there's the 2 forms. Now, let us look at these two commutativities. The Laplacian commutes with the exterior derivative and the co-derivative. So we notice that the Laplacian maps so-called exact forms into exact forms. That's a first observation here. Let me remind you what an exact form is, what a closed form is, what a co-exact form is, and what a closed form is and a co-closed form. So if omega is the D of some nu, then omega is called exact. Okay? So i.e. omega exact, and a mnemonic device that I use to remember this, and not to mix it up with closed, is that for omega, for a differential form to possess an antiderivative in this way, omega has to be a very special differential form. Generally, they don't have that property, so they have to be very special, so they have to be of an exact form to be, to be able to be written in this way. On the other hand, if d omega is equal to 0, then omega is closed. Right? And remember, we have that when omega is exact, it follows that omega is closed. And that's just because d squared is equal to 0. Okay. If omega is exact, then it's the d nu, But that means if we apply another D to it, it's zero. So any exact form is also closed. And then on contractible manifolds, we also have the opposite. If omega is closed, then it is exact. But it's a special case. In general, we don't have that. And remember, this was the beginning of cohomology theory, that there's a difference between closedness and exactness when the topology is non-trivial, when the manifold has holes or handles. And similarly, we have we have that if omega is equal to co-derivative of nu, then we would say that omega is co-exact. And if the co-derivative of omega is equal to zero, then we have omega is co-closed. And the same relationships as here apply also there. So if it is contractible, then it also the arrow works also the other way around. But every co-closed, every co-exact form is also co-closed, and that's because the del squared is zero as well. And why is the del squared zero? Remember what the del is? Del was star d star with the hot star. And if you do that twice, you get star d star star d star. But this is equal to 1 times minus 1 to the power of some coefficients. So it's basically a number that you can pull in front, and so you get d squared, which is 0. All right, so we will use these things a lot now. So first of all, we notice that the Laplacian maps exact forms, so forms that are of the exact right form, so that they can be written as d of something, into exact forms. Let's prove that. The Laplacian on omega is the Laplacian on d nu, because we're assuming that it is exact. But this, remember, we know now that we know that the Laplacian commutes with d. So we can also write it as d of Laplacian nu. But you see, the d of anything is an exact form, right? I mean, this is an exact form because it's the d of something. So therefore, the Laplacian acting on an exact form gives us an exact form. So very important first observation. The Laplacian acts p-forms that are exact into p-forms that are exact. And we express this through this equation in the box. Take any R form and apply d to it. This symbol here, d omega, d lambda r, is the set of all exact forms. It's the set of all exact r plus 1 forms. So lambda r is the set of all r forms. D lambda r is what you get when you apply d to all of them. So this is the set of all r plus 1 forms, which can be written in the form of d applied to some r form, right? So this is the set of all exact r plus 1 forms. And what we showed up here is that the Laplacian maps exact r plus 1 forms into exact r plus 1 forms. Completely analogously, we have that the Laplacian maps coexact forms, so omega is now the del of beta, into coexact forms. Same argument as up here. The commutativity of del and the Laplacian ensures that the Laplacian acting on a coexact form is again a coexact form. We write it in this way. The Laplacian maps coexact forms, in this case coexact r plus 1 forms, because remember the del is increasing the degree of a differential form. So the Laplacian is mapping coexact forms into coexact forms. Now, sometimes the Laplacian doesn't quite do what we want it to do. We may want it to do the clean thing and just map exact forms into exact forms, coexact forms into coexact forms, but it has one escape route. It can also map differential forms into zero. These are so-called harmonic forms, play an important role in differential geometry. So the Laplacian can also map forms of any degree into zero. In other words, we are talking about the kernel of the Laplace operator, the eigenvectors with eigenvalue zero of the Laplace operator. These should not be associated with either this space or that space. No, we call them the harmonic forms. And we give this space an extra name. It's lambda r superscript zero. So this is the space of R forms, the subspace of R forms, which are annihilated by the Laplace operator, kernel of the Laplace operator, so-called harmonic P forms. So what we already see here is that we are treating the eigenvalue zero differently from the rest of the spectrum. It turns out that the harmonic forms have important topological information in them, as we will see in a moment. So what we've observed now is that the Laplace operator is mapping, the Laplace operator is mapping exact forms into exact forms, coexact forms into coexact forms, and it maps harmonic forms into zero. It turns out that's all there is. The space of P forms, the complete space of P forms, decomposes into those that are exact. And linear, they are all linear combinations of those that are exact, those that are coexact, and those that are being annihilated. This is a very important decomposition of the space of P forms. So the Hodge decomposition says that the space of P forms is the direct sum, and direct sum means orthogonal. These guys are orthogonal to each other with respect to the inner product that we defined earlier. So the space of P forms is the space of exact P forms linearly combined with the space of coexact P forms linearly combined with the space of harmonic forms. For our purposes, this is very useful to know, because it means, because the Laplace operator is mapping this space into itself, that space, that subspace into itself, and that subspace into itself, actually into zero, it means that every eigenvector of the Laplacian is either in here, or there. The eigenvectors to eigenvalue zero are in here, they are harmonic forms. The other eigenvectors are either in here or in there. Because the Laplacian maps this space into itself, that space into itself. And so in particular, eigenvectors must be completely in here or completely in there or there. So an eigenvector is never a linear combination of vectors in these three subspaces. It's always either in one or the other or the other. So let's prove the Hodge decomposition. Now, first of all, it is clear that the space of exact p-forms is contained in the space of all p-forms, and the space of coexact p-forms is inside the space of all p-forms as well. We need to show that these spaces are orthogonal to each other, and that they span the space of p-forms completely. Now let's show that the space of exact p-forms is orthogonal to the space of coexact p-forms. You remember why there's a p minus 1 and here p plus 1, right? It's because the d is increasing the degree by 1, and the del is decreasing the degree by 1. So let's assume that omega is an exact p-form, and that alpha is a coexact p-form. So the omega is d of nu, and alpha is the del of some form beta. Then we need to calculate the inner product between them. So the inner product between alpha and omega is given by, well, omega is d nu by assumption, it's exact. Alpha is del beta by assumption, because it's coexact. And now remember that in the definition of the inner product of the Grassmann algebra, we defined the co-derivative as the adjoint of D. So we can put the co-derivative on the other side of the inner product, but then it becomes the D. We could also put the D on that side, but then it becomes the del. They are each other's adjoint up to a minus sign. But apart from that, they are adjoints to each other. So minus D dagger is del with respect to the inner product in the Grassmann algebra. So if we do this, if we, for example, move the del over here so that it becomes a minus d, then we get here d squared acting on nu in a product with beta. Obviously, this is zero because we have a d squared. So indeed, we have that these guys are orthogonal to each other because omega was taken from that space, alpha was taken from that space. So now, let us show that if omega is a p-form, omega is orthogonal to the exact forms, omega is orthogonal to the coexact forms, well, then it has to be a harmonic form. We need to show that if it is neither exact nor coexact, then it has to be in the kernel of the Danombergian, it has to be annihilated by the Danombergian, because that was the third component in the Hodge decomposition. So let's assume that omega is a p-form. It's orthogonal to the space of exact forms. It's orthogonal to the space of coexact forms. Then we have that this inner product is vanishing for all alpha. The reason being that omega is, by assumption, orthogonal to all exact forms. And these are all exact forms. If I run to all alpha, it's all exact forms. Orthogonal, so that means that's equal to zero. And similarly, we have that the inner product of omega with any del beta is vanishing, because that is to say that omega is orthogonal to the space of coexact forms. Now, these two conditions can be written also in this way by just using again that d has an adjoint which is del or minus del. That goes over here. So we can put here minus del, and similarly here, we can put this del over there where it becomes a d. Now, since the alpha and the beta are completely arbitrary, we have that these inner products have to vanish for any alpha, for any beta, and therefore we can conclude that the del omega has to vanish and the d omega itself also has to vanish. So we have that our form, if it is orthogonal to the exact forms, orthogonal to the coexact forms, then this and that, I mean, so as well the co-derivative as well as the exterior derivative, both have to annihilate omega. But now remember what the Laplacian is. It's the anti-commutator of the exterior and the co-derivative. And, well, this term is killed because the co-derivative on omega is vanishing here. And that term is killed because the exterior derivative on omega is vanishing. So indeed, the Laplacian annihilates it, and bang, we have that it is a harmonic form. All right. So now we also have to show that if omega is a harmonic form, then omega is orthogonal to, I mean, this is just the other direction of the proof. We showed that if it is orthogonal to the exact and coexact forms, then it has to be a harmonic form. Now we have to show that if it's a harmonic form, then it is orthogonal to those spaces there. Now, in the interest of time, maybe let us skip that particular proof. I think we should do it. Because there's an interesting comment I can make there. So assume that omega is a harmonic form. So it is annihilated by the Laplace operator, which is to say that the Laplace operator acting on the form is vanishing. And this means in particular that omega with Laplace operator acting on omega is equal to zero. Let us spell this out. See, this inner product can be written in that way because the D can become a del. This inner product, I mean this one with that, can also be written as an inner product like this. There's a minus sign that we obtain from each adjoint taking, but it doesn't matter because the entire equation is multiplied with a minus sign. So what we have is that this inner product, which is positive definite in the Riemannian manifold case, this is positive definite, and that's positive definite. So these are positive numbers equal to zero, so both of them have to vanish. And therefore, we have that the del of omega is zero and the d of omega is zero. Okay, so what have we shown? We showed that if we have a harmonic form, then the d of omega, the del of omega is vanishing and the d of omega is vanishing. So what that means is that harmonic forms are closed, d omega is equal to zero. Harmonic forms are also co-closed because del of omega is zero. But they're not necessarily exact. They're not necessarily co-exact. In fact, they cannot be, because we just showed that they're orthogonal to the space of exact and co-exact form. So that means that the harmonic forms which we just showed are closed and co-closed and closed are not exact and co-exact. This can only happen if the manifold has a non-trivial topology. If it was a contractible manifold, then every exact form is closed and every closed form is exact, and the same with co. Co-closed means co-exact. That means that on a contractible manifold, for example, there cannot be any harmonic forms, right? So in other words, how many harmonic forms there are tells us about the topology of the manifold. It may not tell us all about it, but it will tell us something about it. So these things come up in cohomology theories. And there are numbers, the so-called Betti numbers, that quantify how non-trivial the topology is. So if you take the dimension of the space of harmonic P forms, this is the P-th Betti number, then if that number is not zero, the space cannot be contractible, and it will be something complicated, something topologically complicated. Just a sec. So the set of all Betti numbers is called the, the BP are the Betti numbers, and we have five of them for space-time, for example. So just to boil it down again, the Betti numbers are the degeneracies of the eigenvalue zero of the Laplacian on p-forms. How degenerate is the eigenvalue zero for the Laplacian on p-forms?
But are you saying that this space of harmonic forms is exactly your Dirac cohomology group? But that's exactly what Betti numbers count, right?
Yes, they do. Now, the Betti numbers are a simplification because you're just taking the dimensions, you're not caring exactly which forms they are. So, you know, that's too simple. It's a crude measure. It's much more interesting to actually look, you get more information by checking exactly what these harmonic forms are. If you know more than just their existence, but also what they are, you get more information. So cohomology is richer than that. This just tells you, if the Betti numbers come out non-zero, it tells you, yeah, you better do cohomology because there's something to be discovered. Okay, so we just saw that harmonic forms are closed and co-closed, but not exact, not co-exact. But they're closed and co-closed. So therefore, we have that since the del omega is vanishing, we have to del omega with any form alpha is zero. But then we move the del over there again, get the d, and so we find that omega is indeed orthogonal to any exact form. That's one of the things we set out to prove. Remember, we set out to prove that harmonic forms are orthogonal to the exact forms and orthogonal to the coexact forms. We had already proven earlier that if a form is orthogonal to the two of them, then they have to be harmonic. Now we're showing that if they're harmonic, they have to be orthogonal to the exact and the coexact forms. So similarly here, we know that the harmonic form omega, any harmonic form omega is closed. Therefore, if we take the inner product of d omega with any other form, we must get zero because the d omega itself is already zero. But we can put this over there as a del, and it's still zero. And now we see that this means that omega is orthogonal to all coexact forms. And that's what we need to show. Omega is orthogonal to the space of coexact forms. Okay, so the conclusion so far. We have the Hodge decomposition. We have that for P forms, the space of P forms splits. And this is true for all P. I'm just picking out the middle one for convenience. But the space of P forms, according to the Hodge decomposition, decomposes into a subspace of exact P forms, which is orthogonal to the subspace of coexact p-forms, and both of them are orthogonal to the space of harmonic forms. And that's true for all p-forms. So we can do this in space-time, where we have four dimensions, we would have five lines like that. We'd start with p equals zero for the zero forms, and then one forms, two forms, three forms, four forms. Okay, and what we see here is that the Laplacian is acting on P forms, it's acting on P plus one forms, and so on. The Laplacian, we saw at the very beginning already, the Laplacian maps P forms into P forms. But the Laplacian actually maps this subspace of P forms, the exact forms into themselves, maps these guys into themselves, maps these guys into themselves. Each one of these terms gets mapped into itself by the Laplacian. Okay, so the Laplacian maps, for example, the exact p plus 1 forms into the exact p plus 1 forms. It maps the harmonic p minus 1 forms into harmonic p minus 1 forms. So the Laplacian is sort of block diagonal on each one of these blocks in the entire Grassmann algebra. The Laplacian as a whole. But we can also speak of individual Laplacians on individual subspaces of p forms. Okay, so the Laplacian has therefore eigenvectors and eigenvalues on each of these subspaces. In other words, to diagonalize the Laplacian boils down to diagonalize the Laplacian in here, in here, in here, in here, in here. Every eigenvector of the Laplacian is in one and only one of these subspaces there. Therefore, we obtain a spectrum. We obtain the spectrum of the Laplacian in here. A spectrum of the Laplacian in here, a spectrum of the Laplacian in there, and so on. These spectra, however, are related to each other. So in principle, we get a separate spectrum here and a separate spectrum there and there and so on. But because the Laplacian commutes with D, with del, and with the Hodge star, these spectra are related to each other. And that is a problem, because it's not like with the seismologist, who has a clean case of shear waves being totally different from pressure waves. This situation is kind of too clean, and we will have too many relations between these spectra for the purpose of spectral geometry. Just a sec. Okay. All right. See, I really shouldn't go over time much today, because otherwise I'd miss my flight. Okay. First proposition, the spectrum of the Laplacian on exact forms is equal to the spectrum of the Laplacian on the coexact forms. You just have to adjust the ranks there. And correspondingly, the eigenvectors in one correspond to the eigenvectors in the other. Just a sec, did we? Right. Okay. So this is the proposition. And what it means is that if you take the spectrum of the Laplacian on p-forms, on exact p-forms, it has the same, the spectrum is the same as the spectrum that the Laplacian has on here, on the coexact p-1 forms. I haven't proven that yet, I'm just claiming it for now. I'm saying that the Laplacian is mapping this space into that, this space into itself, that space into itself, is mapping all of those individual spaces into themselves. And in particular, it's actually doing the same thing here as there, in the sense that it has the same spectrum here as there, which is quite amazing if you think about it. You have one kind of wave on your vibrating object, and it has a certain spectrum, and there's a subset of the eigenvalues, which is the same as the spectrum that you hear when you listen to another type of wave. Right? So there's like these waves have a different tensorial structure than those waves, because these are p forms, these are p minus one forms. This could be zero forms, this would be one forms. This would be vectorial waves, this would be scalar waves. And still, the spectrum here would be identical to the spectrum there. Of course, that doesn't mean that the spectrum on zero forms, which is all of this, is the same as the spectrum on one forms, which is all of that. But there's a part, there's a subset of the eigenvalues which are the same. And that goes on through into the entire Grassmann algebra. This has the same spectrum as that. This has the same spectrum as that. This has the same spectrum as further down there. So that cuts down on the amount of information that can be gathered from Laplacians on different p-forms. So let's assume that lambda is in the spectrum of exact forms, of r plus 1 forms. So then we define nu to be a coexact form, which is in the space of coexact forms. Then the Laplacian acting on nu is the Laplacian acting on del omega, because it's a coexact form, right? Just put it in here. We use the commutativity of the Laplacian with the coderivative. Then we can use that the Laplacian acting on omega gives us an eigenvalue. And so we obtain that the Laplacian acting on u is gives us back the nu with up to the eigenvalue. So I should have said that we are picking here, so we have an eigenvalue in the spectrum of the space of r plus 1 forms, and the eigenvector that we choose is omega. We define nu to be the coderivative of omega, where omega is an eigenvector, and then because of this calculation here, we find that not only is omega an eigenvector, but also nu is an eigenvector of the Laplacian with the same eigenvalue. But they are related to each other by a coderivative, which gets us down one step in the rank of the differential forms. Conversely, assume that lambda is an eigenvalue in the space of coexact forms with eigenvector omega, so the eigenform is omega. Then, very similarly, we define a differential form nu, which is the d of omega. Then we apply the Laplacian on that form nu. Laplacian acting on d is the same as d acting after the Laplacian. We have an eigenform, so we get the eigenvalue, so we find that nu is also an eigenvector. So for every, this means that for every eigenvalue and eigenvector in the space of coexact R forms, we obtain by applying the exterior derivative an R plus 1 form, which is an eigenvector to the Laplacian with the same eigenvalue. And that's what we had to prove, namely that we have this equivalence, that for every one of these, we get one of those, and for every one of those, we get one of these. So the spectra are the same, and we can even be sure that the multiplicity is the same because the eigenvectors, we can actually tell what the eigenvectors are going to be. Now, let's reuse the commutativity of the Laplacian with the hot star operator. Remember, the hot star operator maps exact forms. The hot star operator maps p forms into n minus p forms. The particular proposition now is that the hot star operator maps exact forms into coexact forms. So the proposition is that the hot star operator maps exact r plus 1 forms into coexact n minus r plus 1 forms. Let's prove this. Assume that omega is an exact form, then nu is defined to be the star of omega. We have to show that it is a coexact form. The degree of it is automatic because we know what the star does to the degree. So nu is star of omega, but omega is d xi. Now, instead of writing star d rho, we can also write star d and then star rho. And the reason is that, remember, when you take two hot stars, it's the identity up to some power of minus 1. And the hot star takes you from p forms into n minus p forms, and if you do it again, it takes you from n minus p forms back to p forms, except possibly for a minus sign. And here is this minus sign factor there. So we are introducing here two stars. The advantage is that now we have the d flanked by a star on the left and a star on the right, and that combination is the co-derivative. So that means that our nu is actually the co-derivative of some other form. But that's what we need to show. If it's the co-derivative of another form, it is what is called coexact. So we prove that an exact r plus 1 form goes into a coexact n minus r form. So that's what we had to show there. And similarly, you can prove that if a form is coexact, it's mapped into an exact form. So coexact r minus 1 form is mapped into a into an exact n minus r plus 1 form. But we won't do the proof here. The hot star, if you remember from much earlier, the hot star preserves the spectrum of the Laplacian as we showed at the beginning. That's the first thing we showed from the commutativity properties. When I said, look how this is like quantum mechanics. We have two things commute, and that means that certain eigenvalues are going to be degenerate. Typical for quantum mechanics, symmetry translates into degenerate eigenvalues. So we showed that the hot star operator preserves the spectrum of the Laplacian. So what this means is that we have the following equivalent structures. If we look here at the Grassmann algebra, the Laplace operator maps all of those pieces into themselves. We had this established earlier that the spectrum on here is the same as the spectrum on there, and so on. The spectrum on here is zero, of course, because these are harmonic forms. And now we've also found, because the hot star operator commutes with the Laplacian, and we know that the hot star operator is mapping p forms into n minus p forms and preserves the spectrum, we now know that the spectrum of this part of the Grassmann algebra has to be the same as the spectrum of that part. If you go from p forms, exact p forms, to coexact n minus p forms, same spectrum. And vice versa, if you take the coexact forms, same here with the exact forms. So in particular, this means that only half of the Grassmann algebra really carries independent information. If, let's say, you have a Grassmann algebra that goes from lambda 0 to lambda 4, well, then lambda 0 carries the same information as lambda 4. Lambda 1 carries the same information as lambda 3, and lambda 2 is independent again. So we really only need to go lambda 0, lambda 1, lambda 2. Lambda 3, lambda 4, lambda 3, lambda 4 is already a given. And we have, in addition, these connections here. So, example, three dimensions, for example. Oh my god. Oof. Okay. As an exercise, do it for four dimensions. So, lambda 0 is this. It doesn't have any exact form, lambda 0, because it cannot be the D of a minus 1 form. And equal color means equal spectrum. I mean, here the spectrum is 0. And these red ones have to be the same spectrum, and the blue ones have to be the same spectrum because of the connections that we established. We had these diagonal connections here, but we also had the connection that this spectrum had to be the same as this one, that the same as this one, and that the same as this one, and that the same as that one. And therefore, really, that's the same spectrum for the same color. Which means that for manifolds that have three dimensions, there are really only two interesting spectra. But you can take them apart. For example, if you take the zero forms, so just the scalar waves, they will have this spectrum. And then the one forms, so these are vector-valued waves, will have the same spectrum, the same here, plus additional eigenvalues. So we are predicting that the vector-valued waves have the same spectrum plus more eigenvalues, this extra spectrum over there. All right, so but the main conclusion is there's little extra independent information if we go from just the zero forms, just the scalar waves, to tensorial waves. So this did not tell us, I showed it to you because this is important stuff generally in differential geometry, but this did not help us out of the conundrum with spectral geometry. Why is it that there are shapes that sound the same in higher dimensions at least, not in two, but in higher dimensions, examples of that are known. So we thought we'd give it a fresh approach in spectral geometry, and we said, let's analyze this perturbatively. You see, pure mathematicians are good at proving or disproving things, but perturbing things, perturbative theory, is not usually what pure mathematicians do. And maybe that's doing some good here. So what we are saying is, instead of trying to calculate the shape of a manifold directly from a spectrum or spectra plural, we say, assume we know the shape of the manifold, we know the spectra. And then we say, if somebody perturbs the spectrum, that will perturb the sound of it, just a little bit. And our task is to calculate from a small change of spectrum what the small change of shape was. If we can do that, we can perhaps iterate this and get from a large change of spectrum to a large change of shape as well. And we did that. In two dimensions, we have code that does it. So we can get the shape of two-dimensional things like vases from their sound. In the process, we also figured out why it is that in spectral geometry we have these problems and how they can be overcome. And here's how it goes. Let's say we change the shape of a manifold slightly. So we take the metric and we perturb it by some h, where h is a covariance or metric two-tensor. This will slightly change the spectra for whatever Laplace and for whatever wave equation you consider there. So the spectrum will go into the spectrum plus small corrections. Why is this linearization useful? Well, it's kind of a tangent map for a very nonlinear map, nonlinear map from shape to sound. We're looking at the infinitesimal version of it. It's like the tangent to it. And here's how we can usefully study these things. You see, we can define I mean, our Laplacian operator is going to be self-adjoint, which means it has eigenfunctions. And we can expand the eigenfunction, we can expand the perturbation of the metric H in the eigenbasis of the Laplace operator. Okay? If we do this, then we can describe the change of shape in terms of the coefficients that this H has in the eigenbasis of the Laplace operator. So the eigenbasis of the Laplace operator will be Laplace operator acting on eigenfunctions equal to eigenvalue times eigenfunction, when the Laplace operator could be any one of our Laplace operators. But the important thing is, we need a special one, because these guys are covariant symmetric two tensors. They don't come up here. They don't come up with differential forms. Differential forms do not contain covariant symmetric two tensors. They contain covariant antisymmetric two tensors, but nothing like the metric. The eigenfunctions of any one of those Laplace operators do not span the perturbations of the metric. In 2D they do, because in 2D curvature is scalar, but in high dimensions they don't. And this is the wrong horse here, then, if you bet on this. I showed it to you anyway, I mean, you need to know how these things work. But if you want to capture perturbations of the metric, covariant symmetric two tensors is the way to go. So what we need is a Laplace operator, and there are such Laplace operators that act not on forms, but on covariant symmetric two tensors. Choose a self-adjoint one, and then find an eigenbasis of it. Let's call them Bn of x. These are covariant symmetric two tensors. And then expand your H in that. So now the change of shape, the infinitesimal change of shape, can be described by these, by the coefficients that the perturbation has in the eigenbasis of the Laplacian. So our change of metric, so this is a covariant symmetric two tensor that describes the change of shape, can be described by coefficient numbers, really just numbers, multiplying these basis vectors, which is an eigenbasis to the Laplacian on covariant symmetric two tensors. And then the perturbation of the spectrum makes the eigenvalues going to eigenvalues plus small corrections. You see, the linearization has the benefit that it's a linear map, which means in practice it's a matrix. And to invert a matrix, well, we can do that. We may not be able to invert nonlinear maps like this complicated spectral geometric one, but the matrices we can. And therefore, we can go from infinitesimal change of spectrum to infinitesimal change of shape. In particular, it's possible because we're going to have as many eigenvectors of the Laplacian on covariant symmetric two forms as we have eigenvalues. So we have as many coefficients that describe the change of shape as we have coefficients that describe the change of sound. So if we put an ultraviolet cutoff, if we say to ourselves, we can't see arbitrarily small bumps in the manifold, or we don't allow arbitrarily small deformations of the manifold, and simultaneously we say we can't hear arbitrarily high pitch eigenvalues, in other words, we cut off the spectrum of the Laplacian, then we have a finite number of coefficients that describe the possible changes of shape, and we have a finite number of coefficients that describe the possible changes of sound, and these two numbers are the same, because for every eigenvector, there's an eigenvalue, and vice versa, including the possible degeneracies. So we end up with a square matrix, and square matrices are generally invertible. That doesn't guarantee that when we iterate this up, these infinitesimal steps up in order to get finite changes, that we will get always, no matter what path we take in this iterating up, we always get the same result. There may still be degeneracies globally. But locally, we generally have uniqueness. So we should generally be able to calculate the shape from the sound, or small changes of shape from small changes of sound. And for 2D, we've done it. For higher dimensions, we still need to do it, and especially for the Lorentzian signature case. Now, I'm really running out of time here, literally running. All right, just want to say this is ongoing research. Okay, if anybody's interested, ask me about it. We have quite a number of papers on this subject. Okay, as I said, I will catch a plane now. I will be back Wednesday night. Tuesday's lecture will be given by Jason. Okay? See you then.